Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 62. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Mad Max Fury Road. Joining me on this episode are some familiar faces, Mark Wingerter and Laura Fissel, but also, for a movie this big, this spectacular, this crazy, we are having more people on than normal. So we welcome first-time guest from Real Thinking, Blaine Grimes. It's an incredible conversation talking about George Miller making this not quite sequel, not quite prequel, not quite reboot of his Mad Max series, this time with Tom Hardy and probably the real star of the movie, Charlize Theron. It is a crazy, crazy summer movie. It might be the best movie of the summer. People are saying it will likely be the best movie of the year because it's that good. So we get to talk about feminism, practical effects, storytelling, great world building, the implausible becoming normal or accepted, and we talk a long time about what it means to not treat people as things, which is a big theme going through this movie. So, like I said, great conversation, great movie. Here it is, episode 62, Mad Max, Fury Road, and Cinematic Milestones. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. All right. So do you have like a group of people that you actually get together with and talk about films?
Well, nope. Kind of. So we have a theater chain called Alamo Draft House here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with it, but they're pretty great about that. And I'm actually a host there. So
nice.
I've got a little bit of a network there that I'm starting to build. So, yeah.
But the Alamo Draft House is not a Christian type thing.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It's just a general out of the box kind of movie theater.
Yeah. As far as Christian friends, I've got one friend who I talk with quite a bit, but honestly, most of the people, even at the church that I go to, we're Baptist with a lot of old school Baptist roots. Mm. And so a lot of them are kind of like, what do you do again? So.
Did they ask you what a podcast is?
Yeah, those kind of people.
They're like, what's the internet?
Yeah.
So. Can you kind of describe to me what it looks like when you do host one of those things at the Draft House? What does that look like? How do you prepare? How do you get people kind of thinking?
Yeah, so they want us to keep them kind of short for just straight screenings. We do like quote-alongs and things like that mm-hmm. have props that you have to explain. But for straight screenings, they want like a 3 to 5 minute deal, and they basically I just try to think of some interesting things about the film. Usually, because of kind of my background, I usually go for something that's like a production note or mm-hmm. some sort of critical way to look at the film. So like an example, the last one I introduced was The French Connection, and I talked a lot about cinema verite style shooting and how Friedkin used handheld camera work and improvisational camera work to make it feel like a documentary. And I keep it pretty quick and try to keep it really accessible. And then throw in some kind of personal connection to the movie usually. So yeah.
Awesome.
Do people typically respond to that?
Yeah, you usually have people that want to come up and talk to you after the movie's over. And a lot of that too depends on like what the screening is. If it's kind of an art house film, then you definitely get a lot of people that want to come talk to you. If it's, I don't know, Transformers, which I wouldn't introduce, if it was Transformers, then you probably wouldn't have that many people come talk to you. And I also wouldn't talk about the camera work.
Mm. So do you get to, are you going to go do one for Mad Max now?
I wish. Generally, they do those screenings for older films.
Oh.
For those introductions, at least.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
We, I guess, have haphazardly stumbled upon what people are already kind of deeming the movie of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I would... I mean, some people are even... Some, I like how I use the phrase "some people." It's one of my favorite phrases because I don't have to like quote anybody,
yeah,
and I don't have to cite sources. But there are a number of people who were talking about how this is just like the film of the year. I mean, and I know it's going to be J.J. Abrams, but I feel like the movie that people remember about, you know, 2015 will be Star Wars.
Mm. Yeah, sure.
But I understand that Mad Max: Fury Road has exceeded what I would consider lofty expectations. Mm. Like pretty lofty expectations. I mean, we did a top five, like, most anticipated of the summer, and Josh and I both at Real World were, like, hands down, you know, Mad Max. Lots of cool-looking movies coming out this summer. Mad Max is what we're looking forward to. I remember seeing the first trailer last year and being like, it looks almost exactly like The Road Warrior. The Road Warrior is a film that is still good, you know, 30 years later. So how could it meet these expectations? And 98 or 99% on Rotten Tomatoes says Fury Road has exceeded The Road Warrior, which was something people were just hoping it would be like almost as good as The Road Warrior.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, we've kind of stumbled into what has been probably the film of the summer. I'll be surprised. Possibly the film of the year.
Do people universally love The Road Warrior as much as you do?
I think there are people who don't like the film, but I would say that most people realize that it's a pretty good film. I would challenge anyone who has the internet that's not talking right this second to go look and see what kind of score it has on like Rotten Tomatoes or Metacritic or something like that. I mean, like I said, it's kind of set the bar for desert dystopian kind of that world.
Mm-hmm.
And right. Like I said, I think people were just hoping it would be a fraction as good as that. And it's like, it's much better. It's winning all kinds of acclaim. We got George Miller back at the helm. People were they gave people a lot of hope. We brought in Tom Hardy to replace Mel Gibson. Tom Hardy, Bane, lots of other little things that he's done very well in. And so I was very excited to see him in this role. Charlize Theron. Nicholas Hoult, even though I've liked the stuff that he's done, this is a kind of a step further in his career, showing that he has some acting chops. And we bring back a guy that I can't pronounce his name, and anyone is welcome to try with...
You're talking about Morton Joe?
Yeah.
Hugh Keyes Bean!
Yeah. There's an R in there, though. Byrne?
Byrne?
Okay. Byrne. Okay, see. Who actually
it's
played...
It's hard to say. I'm just
yeah.
You know.
Just going for it? No, it's Air Boldly, right? Yeah.
That's right, Air Boldly.
So, I want you to put it into the internet for it to...
Hugh Keyes Byrne.
Byrne.
Yeah. He's English, so it's just kind of straightforward what it looks like.
But he played Toe Cutter, the bad guy in the original Mad Max film, so it's kind of cool to see him being brought back.
He's Indian, but that's an English name.
He looks seriously messed up in this movie.
He does look seriously messed up. He looks like it's been 30 years since he's been something. Yeah. But apparently, you know, he's not done a whole lot since then.
He could look real good under all that makeup.
It's a lot of makeup.
It's a lot of makeup.
So
everybody's wearing a lot of makeup.
I mean, he's an older guy. I mean, he was born in 1947, but he's an awfully handsome-looking dude.
He's
I mean,
a hand. You've heard it here first.
Survey see his picture,
Mark. has deemed that Hugh is a handsome looking dude.
Handsome Hugh. Yeah.
Handsome Hugh.
Yeah.
So we have all these things kind of mixing in. It's not like incredible star power. We don't have like super A-listers, but like you would expect from, you know, a summer blockbuster to at least carry a couple.
Just two super A-listers.
But that one, you think they're A-listers?
Charlize Theron
has been in a lot of
Charlize
Big
is super
stuff.
A-lister.
Like A-lister? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking like...
yeah.
I'm thinking like Clooney. Like, he's in like a
Charlize,
different stratosphere, I guess.
Charlize fits with Clooney.
Yeah,
okay.
Cool. Absolutely.
I'm glad. Blaine.
Yeah.
Your vote counts for two since you're on Skype, and I don't know what it is.
Oh, you've
is
just made right? up these rules.
I've made up these rules. Is Charlize like super A-list? Is she high A-list?
I'm gonna go with yes.
Yes, yeah, dang. Okay, I'll vote it. I'm fine with that. I like her a lot.
Next vote, are we kicking Mikey off of the
podcast?
Welcome to Real World Theology, where we are no longer headed up by Mikey Fist.
No, y'all don't have time to host a podcast, or you would already.
That's right.
Blaine, on the other hand, this is his first podcast, so he might be like, boom, got the bug, I'm in control now. Okay, so everyone enjoyed the movie, right? I know, yeah. We saw it twice.
Oh, yeah.
Blaine, you loved it?
Yes.
Okay, so
I really enjoyed it the first time. The second time, Mark was laughing so loud I couldn't pay attention.
Oh, and Blaine, you said you saw it twice too, right?
Yes.
And so you enjoyed it both times, maybe even better the second time.
Yeah, you know, it had to grow on me. When I went out of it the first time, I didn't really know what to think. I knew I liked a lot of it, but it had to sit with me for almost a full day before I realized how much I actually loved it.
Nice. So I would skip a question that I typically use, like, did we enjoy it? Because, I figured the consensus was that we all really did.
Yeah.
I will say the first time I watched it, I guess I had that experience too, Blaine, because I was actually really thrown back by the fact that there was, like, almost no script. Mm-hmm. I was like, wait a minute. They almost never talked, but I still liked it. How is this possible? So I had to think about it a while.
Yeah, so that brings up, like, basically the initial question that I want you guys to tackle, which is, from a cinematic perspective, where does Fury Road succeed? And Blaine, I know you've already done a review, a guest review for Real World Theology, so I know you already tackled a lot of this. So, and you're on Skype, and Skype people typically get to go first. But you also get the first chance to pass. It's like some kind of weird game that you never wanted to be a part of. So, you know, from a cinematic perspective, like, you know, where does this movie really succeed?
As an action movie, I think one of the things I talked about a lot in my review was how it relies on practical effects. And I think that's one of the things that really makes it stand out, especially when you compare it to almost everything else that's going to come out this summer and the rest of the year that's, you know, a big spectacle-filled movie. And then just in having a constant momentum that is relentless, it kind of, to me, it kind of elicits comparison to The Raid. I don't know if mm-hmm. any of you have seen that.
But we've all seen that.
But I think it kind of ranks along those same lines. I would say it even exceeds exceeds what The Raid was able to do, mm-hmm. just because of how big of a movie it is. I also think, cut me off when I start talking too much. It succeeds in world building, because even though there's not a lot there as far as the plot, there is a lot in the movie. The world feels very big. And it feels like we're just seeing a little bit of it. So, you know, there's the scene where they go through the green place, even though, spoiler.
Anyone listening to this should know by now, hopefully, that we spoil everything because we're going to end up talking about themes and stuff. So if you don't want to hear spoilers about Mad Max, stop listening.
Yeah.
But don't stop listening because we really want you to listen to the show. Continue.
So they go through the green place, and there are these things that I think they're only referred to once as the crows, and they're human-esque. There's all these weird things about this world that you kind of want to know more about that it refuses to tell you, and I think that makes the world feel even bigger and makes the movie feel even more epic, for lack of a better mm-hmm. term. So those are just a few ways.
No, those are good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That hits on a lot of my buttons too. Laura? Yeah.
I think it doesn't waste anything. I can't think of anything that was just indulgent and had no point. Everything felt very purposeful. I agree. Vividly painted world. And the world, there was a lot of attention paid to world building, but at the same time, the characters didn't suffer for that. So even with the sparse script that it had, we had some real characters who had really nuanced background that that wasn't even really spoken, but you knew what was there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was impressive.
Yeah, I really think it, to answer the question about cinematically, I think it, you know, just the visually, it's amazing. It's so well shot, and it's just, it's such a pretty movie. And you would say that, you know, normally about an action movie, especially one with, like, grotesque, you know, kind of creations and looking, grotesque-looking people. But it is a beautiful movie, but, you know, you're talking about the script, it's like that... It succeeds cinematically where you're supposed to succeed cinematically, and that is that it shows rather than tells. It doesn't spend a lot of time, you know, on exposition. It just shows it. You know, there's a lot that Furiosa is feeling and thinking, and you can see it all over her face at the very beginning of the movie, and they haven't said anything about it. You just know that she's gonna rebel, you know, and you just know in that moment that it's building into that, and there's just a ton that's left unsaid that I think some people, you know, just on a general level kind of are put, you know, kind of off put by that just because it's so normal for us to have everything explained. I mean, look at the Avengers, you know, the other big movie of the summer, and it's like they explain every little detail about what's going on. And that's one way to do it. This one just does it really well without having to say anything, and that's really what film is supposed to be, you know. And George Miller, of course, comes from the older sci-fi kind of way of doing things, where everything is just kind of stark and bleak and long shots and stuff like that. So he's used to not saying anything or doing anything,
using his words very carefully.
Yeah, exactly. So he makes everything count. Everything counts in this movie. And it's really amazing how you don't, like, nothing is wasted. Like you said, nothing seems out of place. Nothing is just, you know, kind of there. And the things that are just kind of there, like you're saying, Blaine, are world building. Like those crows, you just saw them once. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what are those? That's amazing. But you get, you know, the kind of idea of what they did and who they are. And they're probably, they could have a rich backstory if you wanted them to have one. But they're there just as scenery, and that's an amazing thing to see and accomplish and do so well like this film does.
Yeah, and I would say in lots of movies, specifically looking at the crow piece, since we've brought that up a couple times, that would be, in my estimation, a point in another film where someone would have had them interact with a crow, and they'd be like, who are you guys?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I'm Steve the Crow guy.
Yeah.
We've been crowing since 19-aught crow.
Yeah.
You know, like, and you'd be like, oh, I guess those are the crow guys.
Or even something as simple as just like, oh, the crow's got it. What's a crow? Well, the crows, and you spend 15 minutes talking about the crows.
Yeah.
Questions no one would really ask.
Yeah.
The words, too, so the words that are very rare in this film are so creative and descriptive in themselves, like bullet farm or breeders or blood bag. I mean, just things that are obviously what they are, and when I hear that, I'm like, oh, I would never have said it that way. Mm-hmm. Or what do they, I guess they call gasoline guzzling.
Yeah, guzzling.
Things like that are so, yeah, are world building in and of themselves, and they're just like this tiny moment. So, everything. Yeah.
So, I think the two things that stuck out to me, especially from you guys kind of throwing it out there, is one, Mark talking about George Miller coming from this school of film, and he has said in interviews that he thinks dialogue is almost basically secondary. Like, you're supposed to be showing people things. So we hit this show-not-tell concept that he is a big, big fan of. And if you've seen the original Mad Max, that's basically all that movie is. I don't even remember, like, 10 words that were in that movie. Like, it's mostly just sounds of people going, you know, which is, you know, whatever. The 1970s equivalent of, you know, dystopian sci-fi. So we get that, and we get lots of people who are seeing this film throwing it back and talking about some of the silent films of old, some of the best silent films that ever existed. Well, I haven't seen it, but lots of people, I think, compared this to the thrill and excitement of watching the silent film The General, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I've never seen it, but there's enough people who mentioned it kind of in passing that obviously there's some things there that he's doing right that's harkening back to the best silent films had to offer, especially in action. The other thing is something that did not occur to me until you said it, Blaine, but I believe this film points out what I've not been able to put my finger on with why I enjoy the Raid movies so much. Because they don't really explain what's going on. I mean, there's a couple pieces where they explain some things, but for the most part, you get everything you need to know about the Raid movies from the action and situations people are put in. Mm-hmm. Now, given there's not a ton there, as far as like what the piece of the story we see, but it's beautiful. We learn by watching. We want to know more about like where the characters have come from, where the characters are going, how they've made some of their life decisions. But we don't get that. We get a taste. We get enough to get us through the story and get us invested in the story. And now, while I think Mad Max does it better than the Raid movies, like I said, I thought that was a very great comparison. So, round one, Blaine gets a gold star.
Wow.
You both get half of a gold
but
star.
I'm married to you.
That's true. I was going to say things that were inappropriate. So pretend I said something inappropriate and chastise me.
Is like Whose Lines Anyway. You're making up rules.
That's right.
The points don't matter.
Yep. Blaine gets 1,000,000 points. And, you guys get 5 seconds of water.
Yeah.
So we would be remiss to talk about Mad Max, because everyone else has talked about it this way, without acknowledging the fact that people are seeing this as an incredible step forward for feminism in film and female leading characters. And not only would we be remiss to talk about it, but I think we would be dishonest if we ignored the fact that that's actually happening in this film.
Mm-hmm.
So,
purposefully.
Yeah, purposefully. Mm-hmm. Because he even talks about how they bring in Eve Ensler, the noted feminist and writer of the Vagina Monologues, to kind of give some context to the actors and characters about what it's like to be like a sex slave, like kind of that mindset that those characters would be in, what it's like trying to fight back against a patriarchy, especially particular types of patriarchy that we see in Mad Max. And what it made me do, especially after the second time I watched it, having read lots of reviews, I was like, well, let me see what I really see in this film during my second watching. And I think Mark and I had a discussion, a very quick discussion when we left, and we kind of asked each other, like, can you think of a film that presents the audience with so many strong leading women? Or heck, I mean, can you think of a film that presents the audience with a strong leading woman who is also three-dimensional? And not just basically like who's using her femininity to be better than a man, because I feel like that's usually the, you know, you swing the pendulum too far the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Because like I said, is there anything out there, Blaine? Like, can you think of a film, Blaine, that gives us this many three dimensional and equal footing female characters?
No, the only other film I thought of that came close, and it doesn't really come that close, was Haywire.
Okay.
Directed by Soderbergh. And but she's a flat character.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much to her. It's, I mean, another action movie, but yeah, mm-hmm. It doesn't come anywhere close to Mad Max.
I wonder if Haywire would even pass, because I saw it and I almost immediately forgot it after I watched it.
Yeah.
But I wondered if it would even... Laura and I were having a conversation about movies that passed the Bechdel test.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know if Haywire would, because like she's the... as far as I can remember, she's about the only woman in the film.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the gimmick is, hey, it's a leading action woman.
Yeah.
But again, not three-dimensional.
Yep.
Do you want to take time to explain the Bechdel test for listeners who don't know what that is?
The Bechdel test is the easiest test in the world to pass.
It really is.
Literally, people. You just need two women with names that have a conversation about something other than a man, even if it's about lunch. I mean, it really is the easiest test to pass. And yet, we've plummeted about 10% in films that have passed the Bechdel test since last year. Yay!
So what didn't you look up what percentage are actually passing? Like what? Like where is cinema right now? In
say about 60% passes. Wasn't that the percentage?
I think last year it was 64%. I think we're 10% less, but I'm going to check.
So while she's double checking, Mark, I think could you ever recollect films that you thought presented any like female three-dimensional strong leading, you know?
Well, women? Not in as abundance as Mad Max, and I really don't think there is a film that presents this many strong female characters in this way that are not Charlie's Angels. You know, I mean, like, Charlie's Angels are, you know, are archetypes, basically, of female characters in cinema. Coming out of the theater, we were having that discussion, and I honestly could not think of one solid one, other than the quintessential one, which is Ellen Ripley from the Aliens movies. And, I mean, she is, you know, the kind of quintessential strong female lead, at least in an action movie. I think we're talking about action movies here mainly. There's a lot of strong female characters in cinema. There's not in action movies, and I think that's kind of the argument here, because we're in the era of people getting upset about Black Widow. So you know, we from Avengers, for those who don't know, you know, we're kind of you know, at this point where it's like, if I can only think of Ellen Ripley was debuted in like 1978, was that Alien, or in 79?
Well, technically Alien, more of a horror movie than action, but Aliens 2.
Aliens 2, definitely thing. Action movie, and that was in the early 80s. So it's been, you know, over 30 years since we've had anyone close to what Furiosa is. And Furiosa, you know, and it's kind of a, you know, a little disappointing to me that Mad Max is not, like, you know, doing as well as some other movies at the box office right now, because it's kind of like she's an extremely important character in cinema now, and I don't think we're going to really realize that for maybe a year or so, you know, when we have time to kind of reflect on how important her character really, really is. I mean, it's groundbreaking.
So one of the things that I noticed when I tried to think back to strong three-dimensional, like I said, like, not enough emphasis on this fact that we're talking about female characters in films, action films specifically, that actually are three-dimensional, and that come off as equal with their male counterparts.
Right.
That's the thing I fail to see with Ripley, because I see her being strong and three-dimensional, but there is, I feel, oftentimes in those films where she is still treated as less than equal with most of her male counterparts. Like, she is not giving typical equal footing.
Well, and I think that's important for her character. You know, and we're going to get discussion about every action movie with a female in it, but, you know, for Ripley, I mean, she, especially in the first one, she's the one that, in the second and third and fourth one, she's the one that defeats the aliens. I mean, she's the one that, and it's important for her to kind of overcome that, and kind of, that's part of her arc.
Yeah, so... So obviously there's some differences. Oh, do you have the thing?
I do. I found
it. Laura has the thing. She's raised her hand. actually, she's flagged me down.
Hey!
And I'm like, yes.
Our pass rate last year was 55.4%. In 2013, it was 67.5%. And the last time it was that bad was apparently in 1994.
And see, this is, I mean,
going
we
back
that's
in.
The and see, you gotta think, that's the Bechdel test for all movies,
right. Yeah.
In cinema.
Right.
You put it on action movies, you're not gonna even probably break 10%.
Right.
Yeah. Scratch that at all.
Well, honestly though, I've been having a hard time thinking of characters that, like, could stand toe to toe with Furiosa in any genre. And I'm really having a hard time with that too. So,
well, and that's kind of what I like the follow up to Have We Seen Any is like, I feel there's still probably some people who, even listening to this, like, don't understand, like, what specific examples from this film do we have that Furiosa does that sets her character, as Mark's kind of putting it, the, you know, she's going to be an important cinematic, one of the most important cinematic figures for some time to come. Like, what sets her apart from Ripley or, you know, the, I don't even remember what her character's name is, but the main character in Haywire, or the bride in Kill Bill, or Laura Croft. Like, what is Furiosa doing in this film? Or what happens to her, doesn't happen to her, that actually have people pointing this out? Like I said, what kind of specific examples?
I'm going to let Blaine go first on that one.
So, a simple example that I could think of is you know, first and last shots in films are important. And so the way their book ended in Fury Road is interesting, because the first shot you see Max with his back turned to the camera and kind of a long shot. And then in the last shot of the film, Max's back is presumably to the camera as well, but behind the camera, and you actually see Furiosa in this low angle shot, this empowering stance as she looks down into the camera. And so just those, the opening and closing shots, you see who's supposed to be, right?
Oh, and she's being raised up to be
the
as
main
well.
Character with mm-hmm. his back to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
He's not even shown fully. And it ends with, I mean, the film ends, the final shot of the film, it's you know, the gaze is on Furiosa. And so I think that in and of itself is a simple way that is significant.
I think the thing that makes this character maybe stand out, the thing that's different, is not necessarily that there have never been women portrayed in film, however rare it is, that there have never been women who are this awesome combination of tender yet strong, you know, fierce but loving. And I think it's that there is an incredible sense of equality
mm-hmm.
among all the characters. And I don't necessarily want to give away my favorite part yet.
That's fine.
But one of my favorite parts is when Max is in the driver's seat of the car, the truck. And she jumps in the passenger side and they're fighting off the bikers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just throwing each other weapons. They're intuiting what needs to happen next. And they're working together as a team for the first time. And that continues throughout the rest of the film. They seem to understand each other without having to communicate via words. They seem to understand what each other needs, what each other are good at, like where they can fill in a hole or where the other person can come in and do something better. And I think that's the thing that is surprising, maybe,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense. I mean, the other surprising thing being that there are so many women represented in this film of varying ages
mm-hmm.
and personalities who are all strong, even mm-hmm. if they are more of a traditional mothering kind of figure or like a warrior. They're all equal.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that's the thing that is so surprising and unique, is
yeah.
that there is this amazing sense of equality. And actually, I read something that, what's her name, Eve Ensler said in an interview. She said, one of the great things about this film is that when you have women on your side, you have a better chance of surviving. It's clear that we're all served better when women are equal. We don't want to dominate. We just want our stories to be given equal consideration.
Hmm.
So, I think that's what's really strong in this film. Like I said, more so than just that it's about Furiosa and no one's ever been like her before. Does that make sense?
No, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, say, because I would say that this film runs the gamut from incredibly subtle ways to make this happen to pretty, you know, not even on the nose, but just very straightforward ways to point out that there's an equal footing. Not like my character had to overcome oppression to get to equal footing, but like in a world where people are concerned with survival, wondering about equality and things aren't really their number one goal. They're like, hey, like if you can do the job, I don't care if you're male or female, or you're black or white, you know, old or young,
mm-hmm.
can you do the job?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, from the very first introduction to Furiosa, she's an imperator, a word that is derived from the Latin for commander, Like, she's a commander. Mm-hmm. And because she's a commander, I thought one of the most striking scenes was when she finally, or at the beginning of the film, when she goes off-road, the guy, you know, it looks like her second-in-command kind of guy, comes down and says, like, ask her questions.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's a questioner.
Yeah, his like, what are we doing? And she's like, plans change. And he's like, okay. You know, he's not like, are you sure? Mm-hmm. You know, are you having woman issues and you just don't feel like doing it today? Yeah. You know, like, there's...
Which honestly is something you would see in an action movie.
Which
you
is,
know,
yeah.
Most action movies.
It's like, are you sure? Are you making an emotional decision? Yeah. It's like, you made this decision. You're in charge. I recognize the, you know, the chain of command.
Yeah.
Not the, you know, the sex behind the person making the decision.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then it's, like I said, more up front when you have the scenes of Max trying to shoot the thing with the rifle. And, you know, one shot left, he's like, wait, I know she can make the shot. And not only does he turn over control of the shooting of the gun to someone who he knows can do it, but then submits himself to being like, how can I help this person succeed?
Right.
Yeah, and this movie's called Mad Max.
Yeah.
Fury Road. It really should be called Furiosa. I mean, really, because
Mad Max Road.
I mean, it's... yeah, Furiosa, Mad Max Road. Because it's really her movie, and she never relies on... She partners with him, but she is never reliant on him to succeed. I think there's an important distinction there that's maybe a kind of a gray line, because they rely on each other. They help each other very much, but she is never like, I can't do this without a man.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that you see typically in a lot of action movies. And so, you know, and I think it's important to kind of keep this discussion focused on the fact that it's an action movie with this kind of female character, because there's tons of great female characters in cinema. I mean, you go back to Norma Rae from Sally Field. You know, she's, you know, that whole story is something like that. You know, lots of dramas have great, you know, Meryl Streep has tons of characters that are great female characters. Anyway, so, you know, this is very important because, I mean, you look at this long list of like action movies that have females in them, and you don't really see a whole lot of, because when you look at The Bride for Kill Bill, compared to Furiosa, Furiosa is doing this because she believes that humanity should be treated equal.
Mm-hmm.
The Bride is just killing people because she wants revenge. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's something, it should be celebrated that she's a female and she's kicking butt and she's doing, you know, this, she's, you know, the hero, the heroine of that film. But that's what, to go back to your question, sets Furiosa apart for me, is that she's doing this because she believes that all people should be treated equally. She, you know, and it's kind of a war. This movie is a war of ideologies. It's kind of a war, almost it's a parallel to a kind of religious standpoints, you know, a very legalistic structure versus one that says people should be free and treated equally. And so, you know, that's what sets her apart, is that she is fearless and powerful in that role, and really just never seen that in an action movie, I don't think ever. And it's you know, it's kind of surprising to me that we're not hearing a lot of dialogue about how important that she is to cinema. I mean, we're seeing a lot of like, this is a great movie, it's very feminist, you know, positivity, that kind of thing. We're not really seeing anything about how important that is right now, because as far as, you know, we're over 100 years into cinema history, and we've never really had this in an action movie.
So she's going to be the candle up to which all other female characters are probably going to be held.
In action movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the thing, I would say the flip side of that coin of the things that Furiosa does to elevate women to an equal footing, and some of the other female characters do it as well. The mothers are very proactive; they're self-sustaining, and even the breeder women are decisive, and they, you know, they're three-dimensional. But there's the other side of the coin, which is, I think they do things to the male characters in this film that I would say it's dangerous for me to say bring them down a couple notches, but maybe the better thing to say is they contrast them against the Joe characters, the War Boy characters, and show them doing things to help success that aren't your stereotypical things. Mad Max doesn't come in, like in most action movies, hey, there's women who need help. I'm going to come in. I got a plan. Yeah. Follow me. You know, jump on my back. I'll lead you to safety. Yeah. You know, that doesn't happen.
Are you sure that they're bringing men down a level or that... Well, I guess maybe they are.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying
they're
not.
To the same level that women are on because... You're saying they're not.
Yeah, I'm saying that they're bringing men down a level is probably the wrong way to put it. I would say that they more contrast what equality with men looks like, or they give us another option for men than to be the patriarchy, the testosterone filled, brutal kind of take charge
savior.
Savior.
Yeah.
Like, they show us how to do things that men, not only does Furiosa, not only do the women in this film do things that we typically don't see females doing, especially in action movies, as Mark's pointing out. We see men, our hero men in this film, doing things that we typically don't see men doing, like not taking charge.
Right. Yeah.
You know, not taking over, helping. Mm-hmm. And then there's even the piece that I really liked where Max. I mean, he does a lot of fighting, obviously. He does lots of punching, lots of shooting.
Yeah.
But his probably greatest act is not taking life. He doesn't kill Joe. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't really kill, you know, any of the big bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that he does that's most notable is that he gives life. He's the hero because he gives life.
Yeah.
Or helps give life to Furiosa towards the end.
Right.
So he's the sacrificial... male character that doesn't have to blow something up to be the hero necessarily.
Okay, so just giving men another giving another picture of what masculinity can look like.
Yeah, kind of okay. Like they give another option, or right. Another picture of what feminism looks okay. Like, or what female.
Because it was
femininity.
Yeah, because it. I mean, to go back again to the whole equality thing, it was cool to see that while. The women as breeders, that was a big theme, that was a big central issue. It's worth noting that other characters, male and female, are being treated as things throughout the film.
Mm-hmm.
Max himself treated like a blood bag. Mm-hmm. So yeah, everybody in a sense in this world is a commodity, not just the women. So there's like a level playing field.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the concept that they throw out towards the beginning of the film that then is inherent through the entire thing about people not being things or, you know, we're not things. But I was wondering, and this might be a really short answer question, but did it surprise anyone else that in a game of what I want to call a Game of Thrones world that we live in?
Mm-hmm.
Is it surprising how Fury Road succeeds at being a movie about sexual slavery without showing any sex? Like, did that surprise you at all, Blaine?
Yeah, it did. Even how Miller consciously sort of subverts cinematic form. There are places where you think you're going to get, you know, like where all the breeders are posing themselves down,
mm-hmm.
And you think you're going to get, oh, here's that scene where, you know, they're undressed or you know, a lot is revealed or whatever, and it never comes. You know, that's where you find out that Splendid is pregnant instead,
mm-hmm.
And the camera, instead of focusing on, you know, certain parts of their body that it could, it focuses on her pregnant belly as she carries the water hose to Max. So yeah, and even the how, I mean, the film is violent, right? I mean,
yeah,
but it's not as gory as it could have been,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
For that world. I mean, Miller showed a surprising amount of restraint in that area, and what he does for women, even the way his camera treats them, is mind-blowingly significant.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because they already had the R rating. You know,
yeah.
There's enough violence in this film, and there's the, you know, brief pieces of nudity-esque, you know, not lingering nudity like you would expect when someone says there's nudity in a film, that you already had the R rating. I feel like most people would just press on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, I've got it.
Yeah.
Why not have that piece? Yeah. But he doesn't waste his scenes.
It's not a hard R, even though it's very violent.
Yeah.
You know, we say hard R, I mean, you think of...
hard R.
Think of hard R, you think of, like, you know, James Franco and...
Any
Quentin Tarantino movie, you know.
Yeah, you hit that wall, you just keep going. You're like, I've already hit the wall, like, why do I stop?
Yeah. No, I mean, what was the specific question again? I mean, was you surprised
like you said, in a world where... Game of Thrones, it basically sets the standard. Or we can read things about how the producers of Game of Thrones are like, hey, we've got carte blanche. It's
sure.
HBO.
Yeah, HBO does that.
So
for sure.
put more boobs in this. You know, put more naked ladies in this.
I mean, if nothing else, it shows an extreme maturity of filmmaking. I mean, you know, George Miller's been making films for 40 some years or whatever, but you know, just shows this respect.
Mm-hmm.
To women. I mean, honestly, you know, that action movies very specifically don't do, because I think it's long been acceptable that's the genre. This is a genre for guys.
Mm.
You know, all testosterone, all, you know, the base instinct of male, you know, that is generally accepted as what a base instinct of male should be, is on the screen in an action movie. That's what the very definition of that is.
Target audience.
All I'm saying is that absolutely. It's probably not really easy to fight crime as a woman in black leather. Like, that's like not probably the outfit that would be chosen.
It's form-fitting.
You know.
It's like Under Armour.
You're saying Catwoman's not practical? What?
What?
Well, so it's, I mean, well, from a filmmaking standpoint, is it surprising that they could do that? No. Is it surprising that they did that in an action movie? Yeah.
I mean, yeah. To make that choice.
And, you know, it's just that it's going back to that showing versus telling. I mean, you can do so much with imagery. Just show it. And you can hint at it, and if people don't get it... I mean, it's kind of like that attitude of, like, if people don't get it, whatever. This is our movie.
But that's the thing, though. There's no way for you not to get it.
Right.
Like... It is so obvious in that scene and whatever else comes next how horrible it was for them to be enslaved.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what it feels like to be impregnated by your mortal enemy. And, I mean, all of that is there without needing anything gratuitous.
To show, yeah.
So, I mean, there's proof right there it can be done.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's part of the thing, because when we talk about, like, making a film in this kind of world, we would, like Mark's saying, expect certain types of things. Like Blaine points out, you know, George Miller shows us this thing, and we're all like, we've seen action movies, we know what's coming next. Mm-hmm. You know, this is like the wah! Scene where, but you know, Miller shows Max not caring about the scantily clad women, he just wants the water.
Yeah.
And we'll put a link in the show notes of this one article that does a great job, because the actress that plays Splendid, she is a Victoria's Secret angel, and she's been in two films now, Transformers, Dark Side of the Moon, and Mad Max. And the contrast of how she's used in these two films is...
amazing.
It's stark. It is... incredibly different, and it says a lot. I would say, like Mark says, some of the maturity of the filmmaking and what they're trying to show in the film. It's kind of impressive what you can glean from a film when you use or you don't objectify, you don't use treat women as things.
I was honestly surprised she was in this movie.
I was too.
When I saw her, I was like, oh, okay, so there's the model.
Yeah.
You know, and not surprised that, you know, like, you know, she would choose this role. I'm just saying that, you know, for a movie that's, you know, going to not be explicit in the way that Michael Bay is and was with her, you know, that she, you know, is in this and that they're featuring her, I thought it was great. Just a great choice, you know, because it plays, I mean...
You wonder if he had that, like, in the back of his mind when casting.
Oh, I'm saying,
He's like, I'm going to show you how to do this.
Yeah. I mean, he's saying he's playing with that whole thing from the get-go by just casting her of, like, well, you know, her day job is to prance around in underwear. You know, as a Victoria's Secret model. And you put her in this movie where, you know, you're respecting women. It's amazing.
Yeah, you're saying she's not a thing.
Yeah.
Which is going back to what Laura started talking about earlier. We get this phrase written on the wall when Joe finds out that the breeders are gone. And it's, you know, we are not things. Is that exactly what it says?
Yeah, we are not things.
We are not things.
Mm-hmm.
So in the context of this film, how does that phrase show itself over and over and over again, to you, Blaine? Like, how does this theme really present itself?
Yeah, so it's interesting in a number of ways because the first screening I went to, it was an advanced screening, and there was a live Q&A with George Miller. At the end of it. And one of the things he mentioned was how he really deliberately, in writing this, tried to make it where everyone was a commodity in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Max is a blood bag. The war boys are exactly what they sound like. You have the breeders. You even have the women who are producing the milk. I mean, almost everybody on screen is a thing in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And at least all of the main characters escape that, you know, in various ways, mm-hmm. and upend that. And not only does Max, so I'll focus on Max since, you know, we've talked about the women a little bit. So Max, one of the things my wife actually pointed this out that was really interesting is you can kind of say his character's sidelined a little bit. I guess you could say that. But I think there's some real depth there to his character that's just more subtle. So mm-hmm. one scene, for instance, that my wife pointed out that's kind of a turning point for his character in the film is when their truck is stuck in the mud and Max is going to go back and set a trap so that he can buy them some time while they cool the engine. And Furiosa says, well, what do we do if you're not back by the time we're ready to go? And he just kind of looks at her with this blank stare and says, well, you keep going. And that's an interesting point for in the film for his character, because when he starts out, he's all about himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about survival. And so even when he lets these women in to ride with him, it's so that I can get away, right? So that he can get away and eventually leave them. But at that point, he's come to this place where he's genuinely making a sacrifice for them that he doesn't have to make at all, and probably wouldn't have made at an earlier point in that movie. So there's really an arc to his character. It's just it's more subtle. So it's long-winded, but at least that's one way with his character that he kind of upends that the way he's treated as a thing. At least at the start of this movie. I don't know if that answers the question.
Because he kind of treats himself as a thing.
Right.
I just need to survive.
Right.
I'm not a guy. I'm not a father. I'm not a lover. I'm just an animal in this desert.
Right.
I need to continue existing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that the opposite of... So when you're being treated like a thing, it's because other people are involved, you're being used. And the opposite of that is not to be isolated, not to remove yourself from other people. But I think one of the most beautiful things about this film to me is that the redemptive the redemption comes in actually digging deeper into community and freely giving of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's the opposite of being treated like a thing, is to say that I'm willingly sacrificing for others. And I think we see that probably most dramatically in Nux. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's definitely happening with Max on a more subtle level. People are freeing themselves by actually giving power to each other.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that takes this movie to the next level for me, I mean, it's impressive, very impressive, and I would even agree kind of with what Mark's already argued, pivotal in cinematic history because of its, to this point, radical feminism in action films, because it's so far away from what we normally see.
Mm-hmm.
But what takes it to the next level for me is this concept and this ongoing symbolism of people being used as things, because this is supposed to be a dystopian future. This is where if things go terrible, it will end up.
Mm.
But when I look around, I already see it. I see this.
Yeah.
You know, I love the fact that all these things that people are can all basically be redeemed.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all have gifts. We all have things we're good at. But it's when I just start seeing, you know, Mark as a person who writes reviews for Real World Theology, and not like a person who has things going on in his life. That's when I start using Mark as a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Blaine is just a guy who's going to be on the podcast, you know, and you know he's just another check mark in my guest book.
Right.
And he's not someone who has valuable opinions and insights. And you know,
and is not long winded.
And is not long winded.
Not long winded at all.
You know,
keep talking, buddy. Don't put pressure on yourself.
You know, like when we often treat people as exchanges. What do you have that I can get?
Mm-hmm.
What can I give you so I can get what you have? Not like I want to know you or I recognize your person as a person. I see that we already do that.
Mm.
Like we already do that all the time. And it is so counter to the gospel. And like I said, that's what takes this to the next level for me. It hurts being reminded that in my day, it's like users or customers or, you know, someone who just needs to go back and make my sandwich quicker at the deli. Like,
yeah.
You're not a human being. It's how we put people in boxes. It's how we categorize people. It's how we put ourselves on a pedestal and keep everyone, like, you know, it's like one of those things when Christ would tell a parable, and you'd be like, I'd really like to be that one thing in the parable, but
yeah.
You never are.
Yeah.
You're always the thing that you don't want to be. Like,
yeah.
You know, when we watch this, we're like, yeah, we're Furiosa, or we're Mad Max.
Yeah.
You know, we're the one who ultimately, or heck, even we're Nux. You know,
yeah,
like we're the one who started off wrong, but we ended up okay.
Yeah,
and we were willing to be selfless.
Yeah,
like we'll even say that we were that, but honestly, we're Joe.
Yeah, you're more.
You know,
yeah.
We're Joe.
we're
the one
Joe.
Who's willing to give people just enough of our water.
Yeah.
To keep them around. And keep them giving us what we want.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's important to look at this film as how does it do this?
Mm-hmm.
How does it, all these things that we're saying about it, you know, this wonderful kind of feminist positivity, but it really, you know, to kind of, feminist is a word that has tons of connotations to
mm-hmm.
it and tons of definitions, and people use it like they use every kind of word and use it as a badge, you know, to be kind of anti-people. But I think the heart of it is like people, you should treat people equally, you know.
Yeah.
It's almost like being just a humanist. You want to be like, just treat people like they should be treated, fair, equal. But the way that this film does that is, and really how I see it, is kind of like this, like I said, mentioned briefly before, these warring ideologies. And it really sets up this very interesting, almost parallel to like the church, parallel to just kind of religion in general in our country, in our society. It's very ever present in our society, and I think. And you look at Immortan Joe, obviously the dictatorship, the legalistic, make people commodities, make them live by a certain set of rules, and then you have Furiosa, who believes that people should be free,
mm-hmm.
people should be allowed to be themselves and should be treated equally, and that's really, you know, from our theological perspective, is like the law versus grace,
mm-hmm.
and redemption comes through grace, and law only leads to death. And so, you know, then you have Mad Max, who comes in as this kind of everyman. You know, he says, I'm going to go my own way. He's this very, like, run-of-the-mill, in the middle of both of those things, and he gets won over by grace and redemption. And so, you know, and that kind of changes him. Like, I love that, you know, breakdown, Blaine, of that scene. That was very... I didn't catch that. And so you said it's very, you know, important that he, you know, his journey is you know, where we kind of follow as the everyman, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we're kind of sucked into this drama through him, and it's those two warring ideologies, and that really that's a very clear cut thing in our society now that we see every day. And so that's why this film, because it's so set up that, I mean, you look at, like, you know, if you think from a biblical perspective, if you think of, like, Hebrews, and Hebrews mentions that, you know, if you're still living on milk, then you don't know, you know, righteousness. Basically, mm-hmm. what's that verse in Hebrews where it's like saying, you know, you're still living on milk. I mean, they're living on milk in this mm-hmm. film, this religious idealistic, you know, dictatorship that Immortan Joe has. They literally live on milk. And mm-hmm. so it's that kind of setup where it's like, you know, Furiosa's, they're getting out of there. You know, she's rebelling and she's going against it because she believes in freedom and grace. So it's this kind of, this film has a very, very well set up structure that mirrors our society, that sets up this kind of, you know, to do what dystopian sci-fi action movies do very well. And that's kind of take a poignant look at mm-hmm. our lives and set up this wonderful character in Furiosa to just smack it out of the park, man.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
So, yeah, actually. Oh, go ahead, Blaine.
So, could I ask you all a question? I'm curious.
I don't really like when people ask me questions.
I like questions.
No, so I'm curious because I've been wrestling with this myself, and I think I'm finally at a sort of more solid place, but I guess this may be a quick answer, and I think we've kind of already answered it, or some of y'all have in some ways. Is the movie feminist?
Okay, so we go back to how do we define feminism?
Yeah, that's the... Because what is it... gosh, I can't remember which one of our reviewers said. You know, it depends on how you define feminism. Feminism can be defined as the radical notion that women should be treated equal.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I would say if you define it as women need to be shown as superior, then it's not a feminist film. If feminism is about everyone being treated as human beings, then I would say it's pro-feminism.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Even to a certain extent, if it's about equality. If feminism is about straight up equality, mm-hmm. then I think to a certain degree it does it, but it still shows that there's differences between men and women, even though they all deserve to be treated with respect,
right.
and dignity.
Right.
I think that is arguable, but I see where you're coming from.
Wait, which part is arguable?
That that it shows that there are differences between men and women. Because I think what you're saying is that, like, men and women have different roles that they were designed for. That's a belief that mm-hmm. is not universally held.
Yeah.
And probably doesn't necessarily have a place in a lot of different kinds of feminism. Because I think, like, even going back to Mad Max, his act of giving life at the end,
mm-hmm.
I feel like men and women in this film have interchangeable roles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But then again, you still don't see any. You don't see any men tied to chairs, giving, like, being milkmaids. I mean, there are
not milk, but you see Max upside down,
giving
like fluid, being,
getting
yeah.
life fluid.
Yeah,
so as many as you
else.
Can, but not
yeah.
being able to escape.
Well,
the
you
fact
have
that
you have motherhood
differences.
as a prominent thing in this film, and then you mm-hmm. have Max giving life through his blood. So mm-hmm. they're both creating life or giving life, and I think that's very important to this film. I think this film is about people being equal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, whether you want to define that as feminist or not, I think. Especially now in our society, the word feminism or feminist is very important to define. And, you know, because people ask me if I'm a, you know, if people ask me if I'm a feminist, in theory, I don't know what to say because mm-hmm. I believe very fiercely in the equality of all people and male, female, black, white, doesn't matter. I believe that people should be treated equally.
But you don't know what you're committing to when you say the word.
But the word feminist has yeah. this connotation to it. Like people saying, are you a Christian? Well, you know, Christianity has this negative connotation to it, huge negative connotation, this huge shadow over it. And I think a lot of feminists who try very hard for equality for women wear it as a badge and they end up treating people unequally.
I feel like it's a never ending hole that you're going to dig yourself into trying to define things, because even if you're like, okay, can we just all agree that feminism is about women being treated equally? Mm-hmm. Then you still get into, like, what do you mean by equal? Like, do you mean equal in every single way? Or do you mean, I feel that all people should be treated with the same respect and dignity?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not, you know, tit for tat, equal across the board. Like, I wouldn't expect I wouldn't ask a man to do this and a woman to do the exact same thing. What, you know, because we have to start asking what does equal mean?
Yeah, what is equal? I think that's an important question too.
Because some people want women to have a seat at the table, like a seat at this table.
Yeah, we are sitting at a table
where Laura has a very nice seat.
I'm so fucking glad I could be your token woman tonight.
Yes, I appreciate that.
I think the answer to the question is yes. I think this is a feminist film. By comparison alone.
Oh, sure. When you're talking about the film world.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. Like, radically feminist.
Hardcore radical.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, this is the bad part about asking a question. Because even though I ask questions, I always end up answering the question. So, it comes full circle. And you've heard us, our drivel of trying to cover our own, you know, butts. Trying to explain what feminism is, especially me and Mark trying to describe feminism as men.
Sure, yeah.
So, Blaine, have you come to a conclusion, or where's the central pivot that you kind of keep going back and forth with, if you haven't kind of landed in one area or not?
Okay, so you told me I wasn't long-winded, so we'll see what you say after this.
Yeah, go. We have all the time in the world.
Because I'm going to feel like a politician answering this. So to give the most clear answer, I guess I would say I don't know whether it's feminist or not.
And that's fair.
But I think there are two things that are really interesting to me. The first one is that I think this whole debate that's been going around on the internet of is Mad Max feminist or is it not? Well, so the old adage, art reflects life. I think that bears out in this debate, because this whole conversation kind of highlights this cultural confusion we have about what feminism is, which is what you've talked about, kind of what a lot of you have talked about, kind of.
Talk was a very generous word. I appreciate
that. You just exemplified confusion.
I would say ramble, but
yeah. Well, I mean, so I think it does. I think it's useful for highlighting that. And I think it can even start some good conversations, some really useful conversations, and has in that way of, well, so what do you mean by feminist? Because there have been some self-avowed feminists who have said, no, it's not feminist. And there have been other feminists who have said, yes, absolutely it is. So I think it's interesting in how it's kind of led to this larger conversation. And that's fascinating to me. But the second thing is, I think this sort of whole debate, is Mad Max Fury Road feminist or not, is by and large asking questions that films aren't intended to answer, because they're not didactic. So it's like asking the question of, is this film Christian or not, right? Any film, given film, is it Christian or not? Well, what do you mean by that? And whether it's feminist or not, or whether a movie is Christian or not, if it's a good movie, we can appreciate it, right?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I don't think that films are necessarily meant to be categorized like that. And I think in some ways that's not. I mean, that's asking questions that the medium is not meant to do. I mean, so is it feminist or not? I don't know. I know it's a great movie, and it can do great things for women in action movies and in film in general. And we can say that it does that and talk about it in all the helpful ways like we have, without having to know whether it's feminist for whatever that means for us. So I guess that's kind of where I'm at, and I really
I wholeheartedly agree.
I've changed my mind, and well, I agree with
like, you. Know, you ever back in the 90s, the whole Christian band thing, like Christian ska and Christian punk was, you know, really big, and it's like, well, yeah, but they're, try this band if you like this secular band.
Yeah.
And so that whole categorization of like, well, they're just making music. So it's the same thing with film, you know. In any way, I mean, it's like if you watch, I don't know, the only thing that's coming to my mind is like a Buddhist movie, and that would be like 7 Years in Tibet with Brad Pitt, which I've never seen that movie, but like, you know, it's got a lot of, you know, obviously, you know, he goes to Tibet, and he, I mean, you know,
explain this more.
I'm terrible.
How long does he stay in Tibet?
7 years, believe it or not. I think it was like over. No, anyway. You know what I'm saying? Like, I totally agree with that. Like, you can't just... It's just a film. It's just... It displays something, and it has values and ideologies behind it, which is why we have this podcast.
Well, okay, so, Blaine, you did such a good job answering that question that you proposed. Or you posed, not proposed.
He's trying to take over the podcast.
Now, your next question is, are corporations people?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, okay, so we probably need to start. Gosh, I've still got like 3 or 4 other questions about themes in this, but
totally.
I don't want to necessarily make this go too long, and I want to wind towards the end because there's still one more guest than we normally have. Yeah, I figured a movie this big, we needed to have extra people, and I want us to all get a chance to kind of, you know, do any kind of come on moment. Favorite. I want us to be able to gush a little bit over our favorite moments because we all enjoyed it so much, and still kind of give like a closing thought, because a movie that's going to likely be in lots of people's not only top tens but top fives at the end of the year, I feel like we need to kind of have a closing volley from each of us, like a final, you know, what our final opinion is. So we start with a negative, if there is a negative. And Blaine, is there any, what would you consider anything that you maybe would have done different? Anything that was your, like, come on. Anything that just didn't sit right with you in this film?
Oh, the negative. It wasn't like 2 hours longer, 2 more hours longer.
That's the best negative answer ever. Yeah.
No, so I suppose you could get nitpicky and say, well, there could have been more plot.
Right.
But I don't even know that I would. It knows what it wants to do and it does it, so I don't know.
I'm fine with that. Like I said, a movie this good, like, we might not have anything. I just want to give people a chance.
Isn't it amazing that an action movie is 90% of Rotten Tomatoes?
Yeah, I would.
Who is the 2%? Fire that guy.
Well, I explained Laura the pattern that I saw. Because, you know, usually Laura typically does not check Rotten Tomatoes very often. She just goes, hey, are people saying, like, are we going to enjoy this movie, basically? Because we go to see a lot of movies.
Yeah.
She wants to know how much we're going to probably enjoy it. And I was like, oh, man, this movie or that movie is at this percentage. And I said, anytime there's a movie that's sitting at like 100%, the whole concept of Rotten Tomatoes is there's the one critic who wants to be the person who gives it, you know, or vice versa. If there's a movie at 0%, you want to be the one critic, because then everyone's like, who is that guy? Or who is that woman? So I can go to their site and tell them they're done.
For a long time it was Armand White, but they kicked him off Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, good.
they stopped counting him.
You know, so it's hard for me to imagine anyone, like, I can see people having, because we're having this segment right now, like, the come on moments, but I can see people having small issues with this movie, but people who are not like, come on, you don't recognize, this is like Laura asking earlier, do people like The Road Warrior as much as I do? It's hard for me to imagine people watch The Road Warrior who watch movies, especially for a living, and don't go, you know what? 30 years later, this movie still does everything it sets out to do, and it does it well. So it's hard for me to see someone watch Fury Road and say, George Miller makes the movie he intended to make, and it is not only good, but it is possibly great.
Wait, are we at your gushing moment?
No, not yet.
He's just giving context.
I'm trying to explain,
like,
cause you said
you can take a great movie and still have a come on moment.
Yeah,
well,
like,
yeah. And then how are there 2% of people who gave this a Rotten Tomato?
Right.
You know, how are there people who went and said, eh, not for me?
Right.
You know, and not only not for me, but not for anyone. People should skip this.
Right. Like, so with that, with that context,
do you have Laura?
I'm only saying this because I'm trying to have a come on moment. But I guess I was wondering how Max survived the sandstorm with his head in the sand.
He's turned.
Like, how was he breathing? That's all I've got.
Yeah. Plot hole.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, but then he like stands up, and then you're like, that man is acting like a man whose body is full of sand.
Yeah. So, it was so then great. I just,
yeah.
That was a great movie.
Oh yeah.
My two things. One is the theater experience. It was not loud enough. It was like, turn it up. I was thinking that I don't know the theater. Whatever. But the only one small minor thing I noticed and was kind of like, come on, was when I forget they were like trying to be quiet or something or pass by some chick the guys who wanted the oil. Or I think that was that point. Anyway, and the baby just happened to start kicking when it hadn't kicked before, and she was like, oh, you know, like, she was about to go into labor or something. Mm-hmm. And I
convenient
was like,
labor.
That's a convenient kind of little trope that they used there, and I was like, nah, come on. It didn't really end up having much effect on the scene either, because they, you know, other things happened to kind of draw the attention, but so I was like, I don't know why they did that, but that was just my one very small. I cannot possibly think of another one.
Well, so I didn't notice this until the second time, but when he's like I can't do a Tom Hardy voice because it's just so deep, you know.
Yeah.
It's so gravelly.
Yeah.
And like when he's just like, hey, Max, my name is Max. You can call me Max. Yeah. And like, I was like, she's passed out. Like she didn't hear you.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
what
yeah.
is it? Who is this for?
She's about to die. He had to save before she died.
Even if she couldn't hear it?
Yeah.
Like, so I want to be like, oh, come on. They use the trope where he finally said his name at the end. I was like, I don't think I would have minded that. I think I would have preferred it to be like,
to her face.
Like, to her being like, not even being like, yeah, I'm not really Furiosa. My name's something.
Something.
Yeah, sure. I can't even think. I was going to say like girly name, but then I realized I would be throwing that girly sad. Name right in the face of this film.
Yeah.
And then I would fail. I kind of wanted that to be a slightly different setup, especially since they use so few words in this film. Mm-hmm. Like, anyway, but again, nitpicking. We can always get back to Blaine.
I think actually,
2 hours longer.
Just side note, I think they actually established that her name was always Furious.
Yeah. It probably
she went back to the green place that wasn't there.
Yeah,
and they were like, oh, it's our Furiosa.
Yeah, that was
pretty important to me, actually, that was her given name. She wasn't given that by a man.
All those soon-to-be mothers out there, Furiosa.
Yeah.
Probably.
Great name.
Probably not taken a lot right now.
Probably not, yeah. Probably
you know, maybe not a first name. But a good middle name, solid middle name.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? Let the child choose. You know,
that's right.
Okay, so this is the gushing part, and you know we try to limit this to a thing or two, but you know whatever you need to do. Favorite parts, a film that's good. What stood out above all the other good stuff, Blaine?
I could do a favorite shot.
Okay.
So. There's it's in the third act of the film, and of course they're riding across the desert, and it's when the polecats are out there trying to board the tanker.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this wide angle shot that shows the entire host coming, and there's a mirage in front of them, and I love that shot so much because the whole movie it's really smart in playing with what's real and what's not and what's artificial, because like we talked about, there's so many practical effects, you know, shot on location.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not as much CGI as we're used to seeing, and then even the music is ostensibly it's all on screen, right, from that guitar player.
Yeah.
and all the drums. So it's playing with what's real and what's not, and then of course cinema itself being, you know, artificially constructed imitation of reality, and that mirage in front of all that, just I love how that kind of toys with the notion of, because you're used to seeing things in a mirage that aren't real.
Yeah.
So it just seemed to be this moment of deliberately kind of being self-aware and playing with this idea of what's real. You know, what's real? This looks real, but it isn't. But it is, because, you know, we're actually blowing stuff up. So I know that's kind of a strange thing to. No, it's good.
We usually, everyone just likes the same thing. So,
but I love that shot. I just think it's a gorgeous shot, and
there's a lot of gorgeous shots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Laura, feel free to try to top that.
I love the scene when Furiosa is being greeted by her old family. And specifically, I love when she talks about her mother, and they do whatever that, like, symbol is about that they do when someone
like they're remembering
on.
Somebody.
Yeah, when they're remembering someone. And then she, Furiosa, mimics them. Like, and she does it kind of in an awkward, like, oh, I kind of remember doing this before kind of way. And I just think that scene is so powerful because it shows her remembering her true self. And that she's able to do that, like, in a community of people
mm-hmm.
who remind her who her true self is. So I really loved that scene, and I love the shot of her screaming in the desert. It felt so visceral and real to me. I mean, I felt that rage, and so those were two things that really stood out to me. I've already mentioned loving the whole sequence where she and Max team up for the first time, and they're just so in sync. And I think all of the acting, I enjoyed all of the acting across the board. I really like Hardy as Max.
Mm-hmm.
Really, just any time there are just so many little moments when he does something or even, like, his little thumbs up to Splendid.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Good on you.
Yeah.
he was just so good. He just makes me laugh in that film, anyway.
In this comedy film.
Yeah, this comedy.
Yeah.
You know, something I noticed, actually, the second time around, which I thought was so cool, is you have some things happening in the film that, to me, seem to hint of life after this horrible reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's something beyond. And you know, there's that scene where Max sees his daughter coming at him while he's watching them, all the women, ride away in the desert.
Or we assume it's his daughter.
Right. And well, she says daddy
at
some point. He throws his hand up on his forehead, and then he kind of like shakes it off, like, what did I just do? And then later when he gets shot with an arrow, he does that again, and it saves his life. And I was like, whoa. That's such a cool, just, like, callback.
Yeah.
That, I don't know, continues this concept.
Could be, like, a kind of a spiritual
mm-hmm.
yeah.
involvement.
There is something.
Some
maybe
kind.
It's not Valhalla, but there is something
mm-hmm.
beyond this reality. I thought that was really cool.
Hmm.
Oh, man, favorite moments. There's so many. But I think, honestly, because there's so much, you know, I love the action movie. If you love action movies, who doesn't love the action in this movie? Because it's just absolutely bonkers. It's it's insanity, and it's so well done, and it's just nonstop craziness. I mean, craziness. And so, I think my favorite part is towards the end of the final chase, when Max is on the pole. That's, you know, whatever they call them, the swing
polecats.
You know, there are those swinging poles. And he gets stuck on that thing, and there's just this moment where they blow up that big tanker, and he's just like, huh? Like, looking back, like, and he's just like slowly going, and he's just like, okay, I'm going this way now. And it's just so, it's a combination of everything that the action was. It was just explosive and fast-paced and crazy, but also funny. It's so funny. Like, there's so many, like, funny action moments in this thing, and it's like, I just loved that. He just, I mean, because it's Tom Hardy's, you know, expression throughout it, just like, oh, you know, like, here we go, you know. And I just really loved, actually really, really loved the sense of grandeur that we got from the very beginning when Furiosa was getting in the truck and they were preparing to go out to Gastown. Mm-hmm. You know, Morton Joe's making this big speech and whatnot. But you could just see all over Furiosa's face what she's thinking. She doesn't have to say a word, but she's getting in that truck, and you know, like, just... I think Charlize Theron killed it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just think she killed this role. I think she did such a good job, and that moment kind of sets the tone for her, for the chase, for the whole movie, and it's just really important and just something I think is overlooked. But she's really an incredible character. I mean, and so many great choices that they made with her, you know, with the mechanical arm that I have no idea how they did, and you know, it's just a lot of great, great choices and great moments of action and, you know, emotion and just a lot of stuff to choose from. It's a great movie.
Well, so I like how we're all kind of, well, not Blaine, because Blaine's was like this whole different world of coolness in his favorite moment. But we're you know, we keep coming back to Tom Hardy a lot and like just these little things that he did in this movie. And I feel like he keeps doing, or even if the movie he's in isn't great, like he typically is really solid to great. I mean, because we never had a chance to podcast on like The Dark Knight Rises.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I was like, as Bane, amazing. Movie, not so great.
Yeah.
You know, like he is able to bring these little things to his roles, which is why when I heard that he kind of threw out there that he might want to play the Punisher, I was like, Tom Hardy is the Punisher?
Oh my God.
Yes?
Yes.
Not
only does, like, he's in line for the role, he wants to play the role. He's like, I want to be a Punisher. That would be awesome.
I mean, like
yes, it would, Tom.
It would be.
Please.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's just, like, seeing, like, I don't know. That's why, you know, we talked at the very beginning, like, A-lister, not A-lister, mm-hmm. you know? And I feel like he's getting there.
He's getting there.
Yeah, I mean...
I really wanted you to say that he wanted to play the Doctor.
He played the Doctor. Tom Hardy is the Doctor.
Oh, don't even start me on Doctors.
He wouldn't have to, like, even say anything. He just...
Yeah.
He's like,
he'd be the silent Doctor.
Yeah.
His eyes.
Well, and I don't know if... I feel like it's one of the links we looked at, but, you know, Blaine, you did a really good job, you know, talking about the visuals and cinematic visuals and stuff. And I said this before the show, you know, that great shot of Furiosa, you know, when she's screaming in the desert, and it's... By the way, the sound editing there with her just kind of silently, you can hear, is mm-hmm. wonderful, and the blowing of the sand is a somebody pointed this out on this is not my own thing, but it was pointed out that it's a paralleled shot to the sandstorm. And when you see that sandstorm from far away, the way that the shot is composed, where the desert is as the kind of floor of the shot is on the bottom third of the shot, and then the you see the sandstorm, that epic, you know, right when they're about to go through it, you see how big it is and how grandiose it is, and then that same shot is very similarly composed to when she's screaming in the desert and the sand is lightly blowing, and
mm-hmm.
you know, so it there's so many great cinematic moments in this film too. So
and so that's the other piece that I hear all of us hitting on, and when I talk about what's my favorite, I feel like it's easy for me to mention this because mm-hmm. it's almost like a gimme, but it's for a cinematic reason. Reasons that make me say George Miller knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not self-evident enough by the things we've already talked about, but probably my favorite thing, the most enjoyable thing for me to watch, was the portable soundtrack. You know, like this war rig with the drums and the guitar player. For so many reasons, besides the fact that it was just cool, all right, like it was just cool, all right. But
no one is arguing.
Yeah, no one's like I think we can all agree that this was really, really cool. But it's not just that it's
bonkers.
Cool. It's that
crazy.
It's that it shows that Miller has created a world with very little exposition that you say, I believe that's a thing. I believe that's a thing, and I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
It's not, like, that should...
I am not questioning this.
Yeah, I'm not questioning it. I'm completely enjoying the fact that that's a thing, and it's not my come-on moment. It's my favorite thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that should be the ridiculous moment that we all complain about in almost any action film, where they go too far. But Miller, as a storyteller, said, look, this world exists, and crazy stuff is in it. So crazy that I can keep making even crazier things, and you're not going to hate it. You're going to love it. And I think that is just bonkers. I'll use your word. Because we got to keep this clean, so we will just say bonkers.
I could use a lot of terminology for it.
It's incredible. So it's not just it's that piece. It's cool. It's world building and accepting of that world, but it's also how it's used. Because I'm pretty sure, Blaine, it was you that mentioned this, but like the soundtrack is basically this war rig. You know, they have like the bonk bonk thing occasionally.
Yeah.
But for the most part, they have music in the background.
Right.
But when this war rig kicks in, it becomes like
oh, the sound editing is awesome.
Yeah, the sound just kind of blends it in, and it becomes louder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it takes over. So you think that the only music you ever hear is from this war rig.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's an organic soundtrack for sure. I mean, I think that's something that George Miller probably blatantly paralleled to. It was a conscious choice to make anytime that you're away from the war party that's coming for them in that big rig. It's, you know, cellos and, you know, wooden instruments with strings, you know, versus when you're with the war rig, that disappears and that, you know, grotesque kind of metal that's playing is taken over.
Mm.
And so that's a very conscious decision to say that this is a very kind of electronic, I mean, it's just even just audio and visual kind of way to just kind of say just contrast the two, but just to see and say one is kind of, because it's not even like what he's playing isn't even really you know, comprehensive music. He's just playing noise through his guitar, and you know, so it's just an interesting filmmaking choice. But I agree with our friend Josh, who went and saw it with us, when he was like, I'm just glad Max hit somebody with the guitar.
Yeah.
We got that payoff.
I was going to be really disappointed.
Well, ultimately, that was the big deal. Okay, so just to make sure, well, just because I don't know if anyone else has one, I'll go ahead and start with kind of the final thought that I have when I think about this film is it's surprising to me. Because I think all year, I'm going to wonder if this film will be nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah.
Because there's a long history of action films, you know, even if a bajillion, you know, no Marvel film is being nominated for Best Picture. No matter how much money it makes, no matter how much it entertains people, it's just not, it's typically not a thing that you see nominated for Best Picture. With the occasional exception of something like Lord of the Rings. You just don't typically see a lot of action films. But I feel like this movie checks all the boxes it needs to check. It's got critical consensus.
Mm-hmm.
It has audience approval. It is visually spectacular. The cinematography, like we've already talked about sound editing. Like there are things that it should be nominated for, even if it's nominated for Best Picture. So it's showing that it's technically a great film. The storytelling is really great. And the thing that usually keeps films like this out is the fact that they're kind of like thematically defunct. Like, as much as we enjoyed watching Guardians of the Galaxy, there are some things that we could pull out of that film. But for the most part, it's just a fun movie.
Mm-hmm.
With as much attention as this film has garnered, I feel like it's thematically rich. So it's got substance, it's technically well done, it's well acted, it's the critics love it, the audience loves it.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't see what more this film could do to be nominated for Best Picture. Now, I'm not saying it don't necessarily win, you know, for various reasons. But it would be surprising to me if this doesn't not only break a mold that we've talked about being a piece where people will, you know, hold up Furiosa as the candle to hold you know, women characters to. But I think this may be the action film mm-hmm. that people who nominate films for the Oscars hold action films up to.
Yeah, I think, and I just want to say two things very quickly.
That's fine.
That ever since they added the 10 nominees versus 5 mm-hmm. nominees for Best Picture, this is the kind of movie that they want to sneak in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, this is, you know, studios want it because it'll make more money, but, you know, I think, you know, people who actually like film for liking film and did that for reasons of including good films, this is that type of film, the one that kind of surprises you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look back through the ones since then, and, you know, there's been ones like, yeah, I mean, Argo won. I mean, Argo was a good movie, but, you know, that was kind of a weak year, but, you know, there were better movies that year. But, you know, Django Unchained. I mean, come on, Django Unchained was nominated for Best Picture. Mad Max Fury Road can be nominated for Best Picture. So I did want to add one thing that I meant to add, you know, somewhere back whenever we were talking about it at any point, because we
that's
talked
fine.
About
that's
this
what final
thing.
Thoughts is for,
yeah,
man.
That's final thoughts. Asian films, martial arts films, are full of women figures, mm-hmm. action figures that are well fleshed out. I mean, look at Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
And you don't mean action figures. You mean,
like, I mean, like, you
female,
know, female
action stars,
heroes.
Yeah.
Well, we want to call them like action heroes,
yeah,
or whatever. But
figures.
Like, I meant like characters,
yes.
mm-hmm. like a figure in a movie. You know, it's just their whole culture is full of respecting mm-hmm. the power of women.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in my discussion, since that was part of my like research, I looked up some of that. You know, you got Michelle Yeoh and Zhang Ziyi, and just really great history of that. You know, I think we're talking about our culture specifically when we talk about like the lack of, you know, fleshed out action characters that are female in action movies. Because I mean, like, there's so many great Asian movies with those mm-hmm. types of characters in them. And
can
sometimes multiple ones.
Can a movie be Asian, Mark?
Oh, gosh.
Didn't we already cover this?
Don't do that. Don't do that.
Uh-oh.
Talk about their culture. Come on, martial arts culture. Which is a part of our culture.
So, Blaine, is there anything that you felt like just needs to be talked about that we didn't get to talk about? I mean, we've already admitted that there's still plenty of themes running through this movie that we haven't hit on. Anything that's burning for you to talk about, or just, you know, like I said, final thought?
I'm just curious as to why the film's not doing as well as it should be.
Well, it's a rated R film.
It is. And, I mean, and that's a big deal. Is, you know, it doesn't have the marketability, but people need to go see this movie.
Seriously.
And yeah. I mean, and it's doing pretty well overseas. I mean, they've made their money back. They, you know, I think nearly doubled
they
it.
They're going to greenlit the sequel.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So we're getting a sequel. So.
Yeah.
Sequel.
Yeah.
But yeah, I want more people to go see it.
Yeah, because the only thing I would say about that is that, you know, I've already had friends being like, "Hey, should I take my kid to go see this movie?" Or like, you know, because like the cars are cool, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like there's cool stuff happening.
Yeah.
We've already, you know, there's a war rig with drums and a guitar playing, dude. Like there's cool things in this movie, but like there's I think a certain maturity level that's going to keep you from, you know, people like families going to see this movie,
mm-hmm,
obviously,
mm-hmm.
Even though it's a great movie. But lots of great movies don't. It's a movie that, even if it doesn't do, like, the most money ever at the box office, like, we're all going to own this movie.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we're all going to go buy this movie when it comes out on Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So I think, you know, it's going to make money. We're going to see a sequel.
Yeah.
But I can see why there's, like, a limited audience for it, because, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't think,
yeah.
you know, certain kids of certain age need to see a child cut out of a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, and when you
yeah.
when it's surrounded by, you know, PG Tomorrowland and PG-13
yeah.
Pitch Perfect, like, it's always going to win that battle. Ideally, I would want this thing to have made, like, 5 times more than what it has. But that's just my
no,
love for the movie. I do understand
fair.
Why.
Yeah, it's hard for a movie this bold and violent and stuff to you know, like, make Avengers money.
Right.
Because it's not mass marketable.
Yeah.
Yep.
Really.
Yep.
So, Laura, what wisdom can you leave us with?
It just is amazing to me that this film, which is basically a glorified car chase through the desert, is so rich thematically, and I just am remembering this scene when they kick Nux out of the truck the first time, and Splendid screams, "Well, who killed the world?"
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty profound question, and I think it's clear that the answer is we did. collectively we did. But I love that the film's kind of answer to that problem is this picture of rebuilding by giving of ourselves to each other. That we can't rebuild alone, that we have to give up power to gain power, really.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that Joe doesn't do at all.
Yeah.
He keeps it all for himself. He only pretends to give of himself to his war boys.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly that doesn't keep Nux as one of his followers. But so I just love that picture because that resonates with me as a core belief of my my faith, you know, that
mm-hmm.
it's about giving up your life for another. And we do that because somebody did that for us,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that's in this film.
Yeah. This
wow.
I mean, just gasoline-fueled car
mm-hmm.
chase through
gasoline.
The desert. It's literally a two-hour car chase.
Yeah.
It literally is.
literally
is a two-hour car. We didn't even get to talk about hope. There's so much about
yeah.
hope in this
yeah.
movie. I mean,
yeah.
there's so much.
So
and that's
much.
That was very important. I mean, hope in the face of just bleak terror and
mm-hmm.
awful humanity, you know.
Well, that is what we say is what the comment section is for.
That's right.
We're gonna end on hope.
I feel like it's pretty solid. I mean, unless of course we think that, what does he say? There's no hope is dumb. Hope is a mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says that, but then
I hope all of like
he
I said,
goes against his own.
Yeah, he does.
Thing,
he learns.
So.
I hope all the listeners leave comments on this episode, so we
hope
can continue
so.
This conversation,
because yeah.
we'll all check and
oh, Mikey,
we, you know, anything we miss.
Folly.
Yeah, it's a mistake. It's a mistake. You know,
hope in the comments section of the internet is definitely
yeah.
a mistake.
Well, I mean,
not wise.
The good news is, Real World Theology is not YouTube yet, so we have a ways to go before we get
yeah.
to that kind of dystopia, that comment dystopia. Where did the world go wrong? Who broke the world?
Who
basically?
Killed the world?
Yeah.
YouTube commenters.
YouTube comments probably would be in the top five
yeah.
of what killed the world. All right, so I'm always grateful for the people who take the time to talk movies with me. I love having people who are willing to do that, and not only do that, but do that exceptionally well. So I hope you, the listener, have enjoyed that, and I want to give you a chance to follow and view more of the stuff that that these people are doing. So, Blaine, how can people find your work on the internet or otherwise?
Yeah, you can find me at realthinking.wordpress.com, and that's real with two E's.
Very good.
And
I
also
that.
Tweet occasionally at Department of Tourism.
Department of Tourism.
Department of Tourism. You know, it's some kind of secret code that we'll never understand.
It is. So it's a spy agency from one of my favorite series of spy novels.
Oh.
Yeah. Because I was actually wondering that myself. I meant to ask you on one of our email exchanges. I just keep forgetting because I'm not being persistent enough with that. Because I really see, again, I see you as a thing, not as a person.
Let's be clear.
So, Laura, how can people follow your work?
Probably mostly on Twitter at Laura_Fissel or directly at my website at laurafissel.com.
That's so convenient.
I know. Just my name. You
Mark,
know me as a person. You can find me.
I think I could find you if I didn't know you as a person.
Why you at my name?
This is a Less Than Mohegans moment.
Yeah.
I will find you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, wait. Is it a Taken moment or a Less Than Mohegans moment?
Less Than Mohegans.
Because I want it to be a Taken moment.
Okay.
I want to find you.
You have a particular set of skills.
Yeah. All right, Mark, how can people follow your particular set of skills?
Twitter at Mark Wingdinger, and then I'm pseudo-monthly on Real World Theology.
Oh, you're monthly. Well, for the past 3 months, you've been monthly.
Yeah,
I've been pretty good.
We actually need to talk about what commodity you're going to be giving me next month.
Yes, I shall.
Really great recent review on Princess Bride.
Yes, I did a review on that great, wonderful movie we all love, and about why we love it.
That's right.
So check that out and all kinds of other fun stuff.
Cool. Well, you can follow me at Fizzification, or you can follow the show at Real World Theo on Twitter. We tweet occasionally. So if you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, you may have already found it, but you can go to realworldtheology.com, much like Real Thinking. It's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. Connect with us on Facebook, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. You can also download the show at the website, too. However you want to listen to it, just listen to the show, which I'm hoping you're doing right now. So it's kind of redundant that I'm even telling you this in the first place. If you enjoy it, please go to iTunes, review the show, leave us some feedback. We really appreciate your reviews. It helps us get our rankings up and more people can find the show. We can get more people involved in the conversation. And that is typically more fun as long as you're not on YouTube, as we've discussed. So again, I love having really great guests talking about really great movies. I love the fact that you are taking some amount of time of your week to listen to this show. So thank you. Until next episode, which I can't even remember what we're doing next episode, but until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Even if it's a car chase for 2 hours,
right.
It's not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.
You love it. You're like, this is the best place. No one would, even though I live in the middle of a desert, it's probably the best place in the United States.
Right.
It's my favorite country.
Yeah, yes.
Well, I have a map up right now, and Lubbock is like nowhere near anything.
Yeah.
Do y'all have water? Is that what the deal is? Y'all have like some kind of natural spring or something?
No. Have to drive their crazy cars across the desert to get to it. Duh.
It's pretty much a desert. We have this one guy who's like a warlord, and every once in a while he'll like give us some water. But no, we don't even have that.